This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with me, as always, is Maxwell Bogue. How you doing, Max?
I'm great, Joris. How you doing today?
I'm good. It's another sunny day in Valencia, so got a lot of stuff done today. So yeah, it's good. I'm feeling good.
Yeah, you suffer so with your sunny days in Valencia.
But you could move
it's
here.
A cold, sunny day in New York, so I really can't complain.
You could move here. You could be
I
here,
could.
Too.
I keep trying to get my wife to think about it.
You should come. Just come for like a week or so. It's really nice.
Yeah, I will. And who do we have on the 3D Pod today to talk about additive manufacturing with?
Okay, so today we got Ricky Wildman today. He's from the University of Nottingham. He's a professor of multi-phase flow and mechanics, and he started in chemical engineering. And he's basically looking of like, you know, he looks at flow in the broadest sense of the word. And he's really looked at kind of like saying, hey, you know what, how do we, there's a super limited portfolio of 3D printing materials out there. How do we make that bigger? How do we make that group bigger? How do we make more materials printable? How do we make more materials usable in a kind of useful way for additive manufacturing? And he's also trying to look at, just additive manufacturing and 3D printing in the broadest sense of the word. So, welcome to the show, Ricky.
Hi, thanks very much for the introduction. Hello to everyone.
Yeah, hi. So first of all, how did you, you're a chemical engineer, so you got started on that kind of path. And of course, yeah, flow and the mechanics of flow are kind of really important in 3D printing, but we don't really understand that much, right? So how did you first like find our industry or find our technology?
Well, you know, back in the sort of deep past of my research, I was actually working in physics and then mechanical engineering. But I was working in an area of flow, and particularly particulate flow, so how powders flow, which, of course, if you're any sort of familiarity with powder bed fusion and those related technologies, you'll understand some of the difficulties in trying to predict how these sort of powders and so on flow from a sort of from whatever silo, whatever place you're storing it to where you actually want it to go. So it's really quite a sort of a challenging area. And that's I sort of ended up in a chemical engineering department because that's sort of the areas that chemical engineering covers. But I got interested in additive manufacturing through my colleague who I know you know, Richard Hake, and he was like, oh, hey, you do this powder flow stuff. We've got some problems in sort of, you know, these powder bed fusion processes. Why don't you come and have a look? And I did have a look, and I thought, oh, well, actually, that's pretty difficult. That's beyond me to be able to try and understand that. But I got interested in a variety of different problems around materials, material properties, how to control them, how to understand them, and how to select which materials and their properties are suitable for different processes. So, you know, my entry was through Richard, but it sort of opened up this Pandora's box of really sort of interesting problems that were facing additive manufacturing in going from something that, you know, is popular and has a lot of potential to something that, you know, hopefully, you know, can be widespread and used in multiple different industries.
Do you really like, I think you've done most of your stuff on like powder bed stuff, right? But you've also done some inkjet. You've done a lot of different stuff. Do you like that you're busy with all these different technologies and things?
Yeah. I mean, my background is very diverse. I have sort of explored various different sciences and engineering technologies, and that applies to additive manufacturing as well as sort of more general research activities. And I feel like that sort of benefited me, allowed me to sort of take on board a sort of a broad range of expertise that I am able to apply to, you know, a technology that relies on you understanding maybe powders or maybe fluid or chemistry, you know, how to code, how to build, how to produce reliably. So, you know, in terms of which additive manufacturing technologies I'm mostly interested in, that's been a journey as well. Started out looking at powder bed fusion, particularly the metals powder bed fusion, which at the time I sort of entered into the AM field was beginning to become popular, beginning to become acknowledged as a really powerful technique for manufacturing lightweight components on aerospace, for example, and so on. But then moved on to inkjetting, and more recently interested in vat polymerization techniques of all its different flavors, because I've started to move towards medicine and healthcare, bioengineering, regenerative medicine sort of applications, which really could benefit from these kinds of vat polymerization techniques to really push them forward.
For the medical aspect of these things, are you envisioning more like the creation of medication compounds that previously couldn't be created, or combining like a large chunk of different meds together so you only have to take like one pill a day? Or
my view is that probably the in that scheme of things, obviously additive manufacturing has been used for medical applications, you know around prosthetics and other areas, but you know, in terms of delivering therapies, which is what I'm interested in, I started out looking at being able to use 3D printed additive manufacturing to be able to create pills or tablets, and really the goal with that is that 3D printing offers some benefits that you can't have with traditional manufacturing. So if we sort of take the sort of courses comparison, if you're trying to tablet something using a traditional tablet press, it's very difficult to get different tablets with different doses or different regimens or multiple drugs, or be able to personalize them in any way. And that's where, you know, additive manufacturing really sort of comes in as a very powerful alternative, because for certain drugs, for certain therapies, where personalization or complexity is really, really quite a benefit, then you can really see how you can personalize those dosage forms. So I spent quite a lot of time with colleagues seeing how we could demonstrate we could print different drugs, multiple drugs within the same tablet, but also take the view that there's no point in doing something if you don't think you can realize it as a sort of a commercial proposition, at least the possibility of that. So others in this field were starting to look at extrusion and these kinds of technologies to be able to do that, but we felt that was constrained in terms of how many you could do, the kind of resolution that you could achieve, just how well you could personalize that. And so going down the inkjet or possibly the sort of stereolithography DLP route, you could start to get these more sort of higher throughput numbers through the production system that would enable you to at least sort of address these diseases that require smaller numbers of tablets or smaller numbers of patients requiring them, but be able to hit this kind of personalization which they need. So cancer therapies, heart therapies, cardiovascular therapies, all these that might need multiple drugs at the same time, highly tailored to whatever the needs are. Yeah, more recently, we started to think more widely about what that sort of therapeutic delivery is. So those sort of printing of tablets is much more about small molecule drugs. So drugs with a low molecular weight, quite common, I suppose you would think. More recent develops in the medicine space are about larger compounds, biologics. So that means peptides or proteins or oligonucleotides, these kinds of therapies, which are sort of more expensive, lower volume, but really benefit from being personalized. So recent sort of developments, and one of my projects at the moment that we're running is really working with some of the well-known drug companies to see whether we can use 3D printing to be able to deliver those in a really well-controlled package and be able to deliver exactly what the patient needs at the right time.
And if we're looking at like customizing things, like the obvious one is weight, of course, right? The dose is like one for an adult, and the adult might be 300 kilos or 60 or and everything in between. And yeah, So that's all, but there's probably other things that we want to customize for as well, right?
Right.
Well, not to mention jug interactions that you could prevent it. If you're putting everything into one tablet, surely you can make software that then says, wait, you can't combine those two drugs.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, the obvious thing is the dose. So, you know, that's hidden usually from most people, but obviously the on the back of the packet of your ibuprofen or paracetamol or whatever is, you know, if you're this age, you take this much. And of course, that's a proxy for weight, really. And that applies to all kinds of drug therapies. Well, the way we think about it also is that you can extend that to some drugs need to come out very quickly and some drugs need to come out very slowly in the sort of broadest sense. So, and you can't really achieve that kind of tailoring very easily with traditional manufacturing. But with additive manufacturing, of course, it's relatively easy. For example, if you need something to come out very quickly, you put all the active substance, all the drug on the outside of the tablet. If you want it to come out more slowly, you put it right in the middle. And then, of course, you can have anything in between. So you can control that. And then if you have multiple drugs, then, of course, you can you can tailor where each of those are in relation to each other. And particularly if you want one to come in sequentially or they to come out at the same time. And then, of course, an important fact that you put there that some drugs are antagonistic and you don't want them to be interacting. And so then it becomes a matter of designing sort of pockets within your dosage form, within your tablet. That means you keep them separate until you want them to interact. Or if you don't want them to interact, you keep them separate and release them at completely different times. And, you know, with appropriate, well, the way I think about it, you can have appropriate different levels of design in that you can sort of pre-program these tablets to essentially dissolve at the right rate to be able to, you know, get the drugs out at the point that you want, or you can sort of actively program them as well. So you can, you know, there are light activated polymers or, you know, stimuli responsive polymers. It's sort of been popularized in this term 4D printing, but they're really stimuli responsive polymers that where you can trigger the release as well. So, and that gives you other design possibilities that you can incorporate into your therapeutic delivery.
Yeah, I'm super excited about these release kinetics coupled like a poly pill, you know? Yeah. So for example, first we get something that protects the stomach lining, then we get something that treats the disease, then we get something that has like a curative kind of healing effect. And then you have one treatment for, I don't know, like you know, one particular disease, you have an entire treatment or entire treatment regimen in one pill. I think that's really exciting, especially in like an austere environment or a poor country and stuff where you know there's the logistics of getting all these pills there and getting people to take them and all this is just really cost prohibitive.
Yes. I mean, the biggest issue that I think we face and where polypills will bring potentially really considerable benefit is that it's quite shocking the levels of compliance with taking tablets. And if you know anybody of a certain age, then you'll perhaps see that you know some people, particularly older people or people suffering from various forms of cancer, they have to take many tablets per day. And after a while, people become burdened with this. You know, we call it the pill burden, and the compliance rates are as low as 50%. And so, if you can, you know, in the first step, if you can improve that compliance from 50% upwards to something significantly nearer 100%, then you know you don't have to change anything. You know, you don't have to change the drugs. You don't have to change, you know, how many you give. It's just that people start taking or feel like they can take the drugs that they've been prescribed, and that will be an important sort of first improvement right there.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's a shockingly low figure, by the way. Yeah, and I can imagine. And imagine also as a doctor, you think that Bob is taking all the pills, but if Bob isn't taking all the pills, you don't exactly know, you know, what's going right on, you know. So there's a lot of it. Also, it just clouds the data the doctor has. She has like less data to go on or more uncertainty around what's going on. You know, do we up the dose? Are you up the dose? Or he still takes half, you know?
Right. Not only that, but the more complicated your medical situation, the more doctors you have, yeah. the less they talk to each other. And then that's how you get competing medications that can hurt you, because Dr. A doesn't know that Dr. B has subscribed something that is going to cause, like, whatever. But it's also the concept of having almost, like, obviously you can't have it at home, because then everyone will, like, produce opium or something. But having, like, a mini pharmacy lab that can spit out the exact dosages that you were supposed to take in the exact quantities, but in a reduced pill format, it kind of seems like it's such an amazing thing. Even if you go from taking, you know, 47 pills a day, because you take 12 in the morning and X amount in the day, if you're only taking 3 pills a day, that's just a huge win right off the bat, you know, a morning and a midday and an afternoon pill or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a sort of a local in your house pharmacy is sort of quite an attractive one. I don't think that we'll ever get to the position like you say, where you have the printer in your own home.
Just but, screams abuse.
Yeah, there's lots of regulatory questions there around that. But of course, you know, pharmacies traditionally have made up the medications on the premises, and so it's quite reasonable to think that, you know, having a 3D printer in their pharmacy lab will feel natural to them. Popular in the US are the compound pharmacies, which operate in a sort of a similar way, but not quite the same way as a local pharmacy. But also, there are pharmacies within hospitals. So very often, there are manufacturing plants within hospital environments. And again, it's natural to think that 3D printers can play a role within that environment and support the local manufacturer of medication.
Yeah, I like this, especially for a hospital, like an academic hospital. They have to do all the weird stuff, all the crazy stuff. And for them, I think it'd be really exciting to be able to do a specific doses, specific regimen, specific kind of cutting edge stuff. I think it's really exciting. But this also, you're touching on a problem, because, you know, on the one hand, also drug companies, of course, have these really expensive molecules. They would love to just, for the tabletization, just save a lot of money when making new drugs. Drug companies as well want to experiment with these dosage forms. Imagine you take aspirin and you just make it act a little faster, you know, turbo aspirin. Hey, that's super cheap for them to do compared to other stuff they could be doing. But then, of course, the problem is if you were going to make this as a technology, like what you guys are working at, who are you making it for? You're making it for these compounding pharmacies, which, by the way, I have looked at, and that's a pretty scary regulatory environment, because it seems like the FDA took a bit of a holiday around these guys, where if you see how tightly regulated other stuff is. Do you look at it from, you know, there's people working vitamins as well, which is like regulatory, you don't even have to do GMP, it's just a complete nightmare. Or you do it for a hospital pharmacy, where they're going to be like super diligent, and they're going to really want you to check every box, you know, and or a drug company, where they're really going to want a lot of automation and a lot of automation and stuff like that.
It's not an area that I've really looked at or sort of worked in at all, but you know, the idea of printing, manufacturing nutraceuticals, whatever you might call it, has, you know, it is being actively explored within the research field, and it's clear that that's an easier regulatory entry point, where essentially you're doing the same thing, except it's not a regulated therapy. But yeah, getting regulation on board, regulators on board, is a critical, you know, is part of the critical path. In the UK, where I have the most experience, the regulators, the MHRA, are generally working towards, enabling this technology and understanding this technology. And post-Brexit, with some of the regulatory changes, that it seems like that we may have, you know, more opportunities to get these kinds of products to the clinic, which is essentially where we want it to be, right? We need it to be able to get to people rather than, you know, to be in academic labs.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it seems like a really sensible approach as well. I know that you guys are you mainly looking at inkjet for this? Because there's different ways of doing this as well. You could do kind of a filament-based approach. You could, what are the technologies you're exploring for pills?
Yeah, so we're mainly in using inkjet, or mainly have used inkjet, primarily because you can have multi-material, and you still have all the design freedom. So there are obviously challenges with inkjet that you perhaps don't have with other similar technologies like filament. But the main reason for the use of inkjet and exploring inkjet is that, you know, there is already a precedent for using inkjet for manufacture at very high volume. So all Apple products are have some inkjet products in them somewhere. Poster printing, very large area printing, you know, lots of different examples of where challenging materials are being deposited at scale with inkjet. And so the challenges are slightly different when you're trying to incorporate a therapy in there, because it's active and you have to make sure that you're meeting the regulatory requirements and stability and so on. But still, inkjet offers a pathway to reasonable levels of manufacturing throughput that I think that other additive manufacturing techniques perhaps don't, particularly filament. You know, there's been a lot of work on using filaments for dosage forms. Really interesting work. A lot of the early work was done on that. But it's difficult to see how it could really be scaled up to a fully industrialized manufacturing technology for dosage forms.
Okay, I agree. I think inkjet, it really has an added thing there. Also, one thing I love about this is texture, right? Just being able to make a texture to make it easier to swallow, or make a texture that also adds to the release kinetics, and that's something that's so easy to do with really high definition of the inkjet. I love that. I also like the labeling quality of inkjet on pills, right? If you're going to be making a unique pill, it's kind of important to know that I'm taking the right unique pill, right? I've always seen this. It's a really wonderful idea, but imagine you live with someone, you get a kind of weird pill from the pharmacy that's only for you. Your partner has a different one. Yeah, you need to have the person's name on it or something, so that you know that pill is actually for you, or the one you're supposed to take on Tuesday, because that also happens with the custom thing, right? We need to label it. Right. And I always think that, all these other technologies are great, but when it comes to putting a label on it, so I know that that's pills for me, I think inkjet will win.
I broadly agree with that sentiment. The tablets now are generally marked and it's made clear in some way what the product is, but there's an extra level of complexity if you're then personalizing it and making this bespoke. You have to make sure that it's yours, but you also have to have some way of confirming that it is what it is, and having some kind of labeling or marking system in there is one way to achieve that. Yes, you're right. The inkjet does lend itself to that kind of what would we call it? Quality assurance, I suppose.
But also knowing what's going on. Yeah.
But what's the resolution, if you will, on the inkjet level of, like, can I make like a chemical lattice structure, so to speak, or and does that have an effect?
So what's the resolution of inkjet in terms of what we use? So we're in the sort of 10 picoliter, bit less maybe, volume, which usually comes out as a few tens of microns in diameter and maybe a micron in height. It depends on what your substrate is, how wettable it is in terms of the ink that you're depositing. But that's generally the resolution that you can get. As a comparison, I suppose, with extrusion of its various forms, you're probably looking at 100 to 100 at best, maybe probably typically 200 micron, I would suppose, is really the best that you can achieve with those filament techniques. So, in terms of resolution, typically, you're looking at a factor of 10 improvement in terms of the feature sizes that you're able to do. One weakness with inkjet is that, if you want to be able to have, say, lattice structures, it's not like, selective laser sintering or a sort of powder technology where it's all self-supporting. You can't make a lattice structure with just one ink. You have to have or develop a supporting that will enable you to have that porosity, and then that would have to be solvent soluble, typically water, but you'd have to remove it somehow. But we've done that in our in our laboratory and in our spin-out companies on a regular basis. So yeah, it's the level of technology is there for that. Yeah.
I mean, I'm also curious because with inkjet, you can also use the conductive inks. And so you could also lay circuitry inside of a print theoretically.
Right. Right.
Cool.
Yeah, we've done a lot of that. That's primarily the domain of my colleague, Richard Hagen and Christopher Tuck, as well as Ludmila Turianska. Working with them, we've been able to show that, you know, you can have, I guess what you would call low dimensional materials used as conductive tracks. So typically, of course, as I'm sure you know, you would use a nanoparticle, silver, I guess gold sometimes, I suppose, to be able to lay these tracks and then you sinter them to be able to get the tracks. But we've also been exploring graphene and other low dimensional materials to be able to achieve, you know, similar properties, but also try to build sensors, semiconductors and similar devices.
All the things so that we can do a true print. We hit print and a drone flies away. Okay? Like the electronics Indeed. And everything gets done.
So when we talk about these dosage forms and stuff, you know, are you very excited because you think that the these new geometries will open lots of new medications, or are you more excited about that they'll use old medications in new ways?
It's more the former. You know, it's the fact that with this form of printing, we can start to treat patients that we previously could not treat. So being able to print bespoke dosage forms for drugs that are not commonly available, that perhaps pharmaceutical companies are less interested in manufacturing at scale, this gives a route to being able to manufacture them and get them in the hands of the patients. So one doesn't really want to print, you know, that, I mean, no one would think of doing this anyway, but, you know, you don't really want to use additive manufacturing to print paracetamol. I mean, there's just no point, right? So, or, you know, equivalently broad generic drugs of that kind. But for drugs which have some lower scale use, but have higher impact, then I think additive manufacturing has got a lot to offer and can bring sort of relief and therapy where previously it wasn't available.
Yeah, but yes, I agree with you, but I think there's also a huge opportunity to mine existing properties. Like, for example, paracetamol, right? It's expired. You're up against generics. Yeah. You're going to keep that losing battle with like something that's a product that's 5 times more expensive, or do you innovate? Right? Do you make a hyperspeed paracetamol, you know, paracaffeine, whatever, you know what I mean? So I do think
change the shape of the compound in order to like accelerate it somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the physical aspect that you can do.
Yeah, exactly. So we're using the same stuff. You say to the regulator, look, guys, you know this. We've been doing this stuff for 100 years. It's all good. You know, don't take 3 kilos of it at once. It's all good. You know, and then you just say, hey, I want it in the form of a heart, you know? And I think there, from a commercial point of view, that's totally a big, really, really big opportunity. But I do agree, like from a life-saving point of view, what you're saying, that's much more important, I think, going forward.
I mean, I see what you're saying, but I sort of disagree. I think that it's difficult to see the commercial opportunity in manufacturing something like paracetamol or equivalent with additive manufacturing. It's done by the millions at the moment with a very simple method. And I think it would be a mistake to try to displace that with, you know, a technology that perhaps would just be a little bit more expensive and wouldn't add anything to it. So, you know, our philosophy with this technology is always to try and find out where, you know, where you can make the biggest impact. And there's no point in trying to displace something that works well. It's seeking out those opportunities where, you know, traditional manufacturing has not really been able to achieve what you'd hope. And there are perhaps, you know, in the medicine space, people who don't have access to drugs that they should get access to. And this kind of technology can potentially achieve that.
Fair enough. As a societal utility thing, Totally. As a financial thing, I think we can argue about this. Oh, one thing, actually, before I forget.
It's about an ease to entrance in the market and regulatory.
Exactly. It's, I don't know. But also, one thing I keep forgetting to mention is like one thing I'm really enthusiastic about is just making pills look like when you take them, for example. You know? Like kind of like
looks like a heart for a heart pill, looks like a liver for a liver pill. It's a stomach.
Like, stomach. It looks like a chicken leg and you take it before the meal, you know? It looks like a cake, you take it after dessert.
Or you take it with food and it looks like a knife and a fork.
No, I'm absolutely serious about
this. You're not wrong. Like, it's a good reminder, especially like, because you know, you're not always reading the damn pill bottles.
But and then I just wanted to mention that before I forgot. But and then there's another thing I'm thinking about. This is like we saw what Spiritam or something that got regulatory approval, right?
Right.
Then it seemed like there was FabRx, there was Kraft Health, there was all these people interested, right? And now is there like a quiet renaissance going on with these big drug companies investing tons and tons of money? We're not seeing it, or are these guys? Because we're seeing like it seems like the announcements have not on the pill front have just not been there yet, or is it just going to take a long time for you guys to figure this technology out before they can actually make it work?
Yeah, I mean the Spritam dosage form was really interesting. You know, it was a sort of a break point for 3D printing of dosage forms, but I guess it's fair to say that you know the kind of revolution hasn't come off the back of that, possibly because with that dosage form. You know, it's a great example of where 3D printing can make a difference. But ultimately, that product didn't use all the benefits of 3D printing and exemplify that. And possibly that's why, you know, we haven't seen a sort of a great influx of 3D printed dosage forms commercially available. I think the larger pharmaceutical companies, as you know, we work with some of those, and there is a long-standing interest in this technology and how it might be used, and we work closely with those. There is an enthusiasm for it, but you know, there's a lot of inertia in that field, not only from a regulatory point of view, but also because you know there is long-standing investment in current manufacturing technologies that would need to be displaced in order to take it on board. So if 3D printing of dosage forms is really going to take off, it needs to get in at the ground rather than try to displace already established technologies for manufacturing current products. And we know how long it takes to develop a drug. You know, that sort of, you know, what is it, 10, 15 years potentially. You know, so it's really about trying to find out what, you know, find the right product, the right people in the pharmaceutical companies and really finding the enthusiasts to be able to really be willing to invest in, you know, what I suppose is quite a risky proposition. To not only you have the risk of a new molecule coming out, a new drug, you also have the risk of taking on board a different sort of manufacturing technology as well. And I guess sometimes that appetite is not always there. But I think when we talk to people in the pharmaceutical industry of all signs, there is an enthusiasm for the technology. It's just a little bit, you know, somebody's got to jump at some point. Perhaps we're all just waiting for somebody to jump and then follow.
Yeah, someone's got to go through the wall and lose their shirt.
Yes.
And then someone else will be like, that was a good idea.
And are you, like, I know you've done stuff in 3D printing electronics as well. You mentioned some stuff you did before and worked in sensors and that kind of thing. There seems to be a lot going on in that front with, like, you know, the Apple Watch, you know, maybe depending on where you are in the world, being able to tell your blood oxygen level.
Which patent?
I can do that. You can. You know, these kind of things. Do you believe a lot about the sensor, you know, body sensors in on the body? Is that something you're looking at as well, or is that something you're less interested in?
It's certainly an area that we're looking at. It's not one of the areas that is of, you know, primary focus, but, you know, being able to interact with the skin or the nerves with a sensor would be very powerful. It's just a question of overcoming some of the really significant difficulties of that, which I think right now we're not quite in a position to be able to do. We don't really fully understand how the body responds to implants to longstanding contact with, you know, various different materials. And I think that's an ongoing area of research. It's exciting. And obviously there are, you know, some people out there are making large pronouncements about how technology interacts with the human nervous system. But I think at the moment, most of the exciting area is in sort of sensing of metabolites and sensing of sweat and these kinds of things. And that's not really an area that I've really looked at too much.
Okay. All right. I just think it just seems to be going like that way as well. And again, the approval thing for this is, yeah, that's it's good that you pointed that out, because that is going to be huge, because, like, you know, we know that regulators don't love medicated stents. So if they see this as a similar kind of thing, then yeah, definitely they're going to be very, very careful.
One of the issues that we face in the regulatory industry is, you know, one of my other areas of interest is in regenerative medicine. And so that means the delivery of cells, not only of drugs. And one of the complications you often get is that you suddenly get into mixed devices. So you're trying to deliver a drug or you're trying to deliver a cell. You have a device, perhaps it's a sensor. And then all of a sudden you have to satisfy all the regulatory concerns for all those different types of therapeutic devices. And then so it's sort of regulatory cubed at that point. And it just becomes a nightmare. So you have to be quite careful in exactly what it is you're trying to sort of package in your device.
I think that's a good point, because I think these things are all going to get really, really complicated and convoluted as these systems get more mature and more complex.
Yeah.
You know, a little, you know, a probe that goes in the body and lets drugs go at a certain schedule, or depending on your pH and stuff like that. Yeah. What is that? Right. Mm. And I hope that regulators are careful, frankly, with this kind of stuff, because it can be really terrifying.
Like, goes in the body. Yeah.
Little robots in your body, like gray goo and stuff. Yeah, no thanks. And then the other thing, are you doing anything in additive and regenerative medicine as well? Or?
Yeah. So that's sort of a big part of my recent work is going beyond the sort of delivery of molecules. So, you know, small molecules or biologics. So, and starting working with colleagues here around delivery of cells. So one particular project that we're working on is to be able to create what we're calling an intestinal patch. And this is predicated on if you have Crohn's disease or some kind of inflammation of the bowel. Basically, what happens is your intestine degrades, the epithelial layer in your intestine degrades, and it relies on replenishment through the stem cells that reside in there in sort of niches, pockets in the intestinal lining. And when they go, basically, when the epithelial layer, the outermost layer of the intestine sort of degrades, there's no way of regenerating it. There's no healing capacity left. So you have a kind of a double whammy, both the sort of tissue degrades, but and it has no healing capacity at the same time. And so we've been really trying to look at whether we could replicate some of the features that you see in the intestine that have that basically are cellular, are tissue level, so creating pockets in which stem cells reside. You can then you can place the stem cells within this sort of environment that replicates what the intestine would be like, and then implant that to be able to sort of regenerate the sort of intestine of someone who's suffering from some kind of inflammatory bowel disease. It's really quite exciting. It's sort of a very different proposition from delivering drugs, because obviously cells are sort of almost sort of autonomous. They don't do what you want it want you you want them to do, and you you have to go through quite significant hurdles to be able to sort of replicate these tissues. But yeah, it's looking very promising. It's very exciting area.
Yeah, but that also, like, I think is going to take a longer time, especially keeping all that alive and stuff like that is going to be, you know, going to be really complicated, much more complicated, I think, than most lay people assume. You know,
when I talk about people working. Yeah, cells.
Yeah. I agree. You know, when I entered the regenerative medicine, bioprinting field, that the history of that field is very much like we'll be able to rebuild organs. You know, we'll rebuild the liver, we'll rebuild
the kidney. That was the dream.
It's a dream, yeah. So it's that hasn't really turned out to have been realized. We're focused more on targeting small parts of the tissue that, you know, are tractable. The intestine is attractive because it's one of the organs that we know most about, and there's been a lot of research in that area, and working with clinicians, we feel that we have a reasonable handle as far as you can with biology and being able to replicate the biological, the chemical, and also the sort of the mechanical material features there. But it's quite exciting when you look at what's going on in the field, and I'm sure you've seen sort of these announcements from, say, 3D Systems and United Therapeutics, who are looking at being able to, you know, rebuild the whole of the lung, and so I think in the last 5 years the field has really jumped forward in terms of acknowledging that it has to harness these sort of high throughput, well, high resolution 3D printing techniques if it's going to be able to try and replicate some of the key features that means that organs or parts of organs can function. Whereas in the past, I don't think that was the case.
Is it because you guys are trying to tackle a much, I don't want to say simpler, but it's a better understood problem at the end of the day, and that's what makes it more realistic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, biology is so complex that you can't really tackle everything. So we've tried to sort of simplify everything down to understanding, you know, a small number of characteristics of that part of the organ, and not try to ram everything in that you would see biologically, because otherwise then you have so many variables, you have so many factors, you don't have control, and you you're not going to be able to replicate the main characteristics of that. So yeah, simple enough that it works is really the goal.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I would like to point out to everyone that if you fold out a complete lung, it's the size of a basketball court, right? That's just to give us a little bit of the throughput. The throughput problem is, of course, also kind of quite significant, I think.
Mm.
One thing that's really interesting is I think nowadays we're more used to scientists being like, I'm a mechanical engineer and I specialize in titanium failure or whatever, right?
Yeah,
but I remember I was thinking at one point. I read an article. I think the first article I wrote and read by you. I think it was on TPMS structures and metal printing or something like this, right? And that is like completely like a million years from where you are now, right?
Right.
But as like so, on the one hand, if in a publisher Paris world, you need to be much more specialized now if you want to make an impact. So it's like not only titanium failure, but it's titanium, 64 failure and aerostructures. You know what I mean? Everybody gets more and more specialized. But then there's very few people that are making these bridging technologies that really take place in really different environments, right? Inkjet in a lot of different realms, for example, or flow. Do you think that's a kind of, I think more scientists should be like you or more researchers?
It's not for me to say what other scientists should be like, but I think, as I said at the beginning, I feel I've benefited from exploring these different areas and building up a broad expertise rather than being very strongly narrow. For one thing, it's more interesting. But the other, it's sort of, I feel that, for example, the regenerative medicine problem, you can't do that on your own. You can't do that by being highly specialized. You have to be able to bring together a team of people with complementary expertise and be able to mesh that together. I think most of the successful teams I see are sort of work like that. I think the time of the very narrow, highly specialized, very specialized academic is not over, but I don't think you can achieve as much working like that as you can by having a broad knowledge and working as part as a team.
Okay, I definitely think a lot of science. No, a lot of science is a team sport right now, right? There's additive stuff like that. And then, but what do you want to achieve, Ricky? Do you have a direction you're going somewhere you want to, like some burning problem you want to solve, or you just want to know more, do more? What's your idea?
Well, I always want to know more and do more. But really, my focus at the moment is twofold, I suppose. One is really focused on this aspect of work that I haven't really touched on here, but you mentioned at the beginning about trying to bring systems and, I guess I call them toolkits, to the field that enable more people to use and leverage the power of additive manufacturing. So, you know, quite a long time ago, you know, as I suppose as a relatively late entrant to the field, I realized that whilst there was a lot of promise, you know, it wasn't as widespread as it should be. And when you start asking people why, you realize that, well, actually people, you know, they don't know where to start. Well, not only they don't know where to start, they don't know where, you know, they don't know what they're doing in the middle, and they don't know what they're doing at the end, because it's a disruptive technology. It's relatively new. What materials do you use? How do you design? You know, how do you use this? You know, it all requires, on the whole, or at least, up until recently, technologies that most of us weren't really familiar with. So if we can build together a sort of a workflow, a toolkit that enables somebody who is, what's the right word, is it's not necessarily an expert in 3D printing, but an expert in their own field, can come along and have the path to being able to realize their idea and their product made easier, then we'll start to see 3D printing much more widely used and benefit us all. So, you know, really that's my focus at the moment, is to be able to, it's sort of a little bit nebulous in these ideas of toolkits and workflows and things like that, but you know, if we can bring these tools together, if we can, I call it dialing up. If somebody comes along and says, "Oh, I have this vision for this product, could be intestinal patch, whatever it is, like, what materials should I use? What design should it be?" They should be able to sit in front of a computer and sort of press a button, and out pops, use this material with this material with this design, and with this 3D printer, and you'll get the product that you want. Rather than at the moment, they'd have to spend sort of 10 years learning all the technology to be able to get there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think I remember one thing. It's just completely unrelated, but still at the same time, like, there was the guys actually at a Dutch hospital, and they were looking at the making 3D printed implants, and they really for a long time thought that we're like kind of pioneering this thing, and they just didn't know that all this other stuff was going on. So they really all of a sudden, quite late in their process, discovered the largest companies making orthopedic implants. They were trying to do it for cancer trauma, right? Yeah. And then they all of a sudden discovered all this literature and all this other stuff going back many, many years under many different names for the stuff they were doing. And it was just like, you know, that's a lack of knowledge, but I was just like, you know, it should be more universal. I know you did this thing for the medical toolkit, right? That's one example for that, right? How did that work, or how does that work? Because you're still on that, right?
Yeah, that's still developing. So it's all coming together. Right now, you know, one of the drivers, sort of similar to that story you've got, is one of the drivers is, you know, as an academic, coming up with research ideas and so on. The fear is that you come up with a great idea and, you know, we're encouraged to commercialize and spin out and so on. And you do all that, and then you get to the point where you realize that actually it's not commercially viable for some simple, non-academic, but industrially sensible reason. You know, we're trying to sort of, you know, compress that kind of like pathway so that we start thinking about what makes something commercially or clinically viable right at the start and build that in, rather than perhaps a more traditional academic approach where, you know, you're blue skies and you think about all these ideas and they can be really cool and you can do all these things, but, you know, I'm never going to come to pass because, I don't know, you can never make them in the right size or in the right amounts to, you know, for a company to want to drive it forward.
Yeah, I think that's cool. I think that's really, really good work you're doing. I think we should do more like that kind of approach where, you know, it's not a book, it's not a paper, it's not a course, but it's just some kind of like a really, really, really flexible tool to really give you get you up to speed faster. I think it's a wonderful idea. But Ricky, thank you so much for being here today with us, Ricky.
Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
No problem. And thank you for being here as well, Max.
Always. Thank you, Joyce.
And thank you for listening. This is another episode of the 3D Pod. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.